to other mountains and other times. His very step seemed lighter, to have regained a lost agility. I, on the other hand, was exhausted. Exertion and the lack of oxygen tightened my stomach and made me feel sick. This nausea made every meter a struggle. My father was incapable of noticing. Approaching 3,000 meters, the path became less distinct. On the scree, there remained only stone cairns and signs daubed in paint, and he would finally take his place at the head of the expedition. He wouldn't look around to check on how I was. If he did turn, it was only so as to shout out, "Look!" pointing out, on the ridge of the crest above, the horns of the ibexes who were keeping an eye on us, like guardians of that mineral world. Looking up, the summit still seemed very far off to me. My nostrils were filled with the smell of frozen snow and flint. The end of this torture would arrive unexpectedly. I would make one last leap, go around a rocky outcrop, and suddenly find myself before a pile of stones or a lightning-stricken iron cross, my father's rucksack flung on the ground, beyond it nothing but sky. It was more of a relief than a cause for elation. There was no reward awaiting us up there. Apart from the fact that we could climb no further, there was nothing really special about the summit. I would have been happier reaching a river or a village. On the summit, my father became reflective. He would take off his shirt and vest and hang them on the cross to dry. It was only on rare occasions that I saw him like this, and bare-chested, his body had something vulnerable about it, with his reddened forearms, his strong white shoulders, the small gold chain that he never took off, his neck also red and covered in dust. We would sit down to eat bread and cheese and to contemplate the panoramic view. In front of us stood the entire massif of Monte Rosa, so close that we could make out the refuges, the cable cars, the artificial lakes, the long procession of roped figures on their way back from the Margarita hut. My father would then unstop his canteen of wine and smoke his single morning cigarette. "It isn't called Rosa because it's pink," he would say. "It comes from an old word for ice, the Ice Mountain." Then he would list the 4,000ers, the peaks above 4,000 meters, from east to west, saying them over again because before going there it was important to know them, to have cultivated a long-standing desire for them. The modest Punta Giordani, the Pyramid de Vincent towering over it, the Balmenhorn on which the great Christ of the Summits rises, the Parota, with an outline so gentle that it's almost invisible. Then the noble peaks of the three sharp-pointed sisters, Nifeti, Sumstein, and Dufour. The two Luscombe with the ridge that joins them, the devourer of men. And at the end, the elegantly curved profile of Castor, the rugged Pollux, the deeply carved Black Rock, the Brighthorn with its seemingly innocuous air. Finally, to the west, sculpted and solitary, the Matterhorn, which my father called the Big Nose, as if it were an elderly aunt of his. He did not willingly turn south towards the plains. Down there the August haze hung heavily, and somewhere beneath that gray blanket, Milan was sweltering. "It all looks so small, doesn't it?" he would say. And I did not understand. I could not understand in what possible sense that magisterial panorama could seem small to him. Perhaps it was other things that seemed small, things that came back to him when he was up there. But his melancholy did not last for long. His cigarette finished, he would extract himself from the mire of his thoughts, collect his things, and say, "Shall we go?" We took the descent at a run, going down every slope at breakneck speed, letting out war cries and American Indian howls, and in less than 2 hours would be soaking our feet in some village fountain. In Grana, my mother had made progress with her investigations. I would often spot her in the field where Bruno's mother spent her days. If you glanced up in that direction, you would always see her there, a bony woman wearing a yellow beret, bent over, tending her onions and potatoes. She never exchanged a word with anyone, and no one would seek her out there until my mother decided to do so. One of them in the allotment, the other sitting on a tree stump nearby. From a distance, it seemed as if they had been chatting there for hours. "So she does speak, then," said my father, who had heard from us about this strange woman. "Of course she speaks. I've never known anyone who was mute," my mother replied.
"More's the pity," he remarked.
but she wasn't in the mood for jokes. She had discovered that Bruno had not advanced beyond primary school that year, and she was furious about it. He had not been to school since April. It was clear that if no one intervened, then his education was already at an end, and this was the kind of thing that made my mother indignant, every bit as much in a small mountain village as in Milan. "You can't always be rescuing everyone," my father said.
"But someone rescued you, or am I wrong?"
"True enough, but then I had to rescue myself from them."
"But you did get to study. They didn't force you to herd cows when you were 11 years old. At 11 you should be going to school."
"I'm just saying that it's different in this case. He does have parents, luckily."
"Some luck," my mother concluded, and my father did not respond. They almost never touched upon the subject of his own childhood, and on those rare occasions he would shake his head and let the subject drop. And so it was that we were sent, my father and I, as an advance party to forge links with the men of the Guglielmina family. The alpeggio, or farmstead, where they spent the summer, consisted of a group of three mountain shacks about an hour's distance from Grana along the track that climbed up the deep valley. We caught sight of them from a distance, perched on its right flank, where the mountain became less steep just before plunging down again until it reached the same stream that flowed through the village. I was already very fond of that little river. I was pleased to meet up with it again there. At this point, the valley seemed to close, as if an immense landslide had blocked it upstream, and it ended in a basin watered by small streams and overrun with ferns, bushes of rhubarb, and nettles. Passing through it, the way became boggy. Then, leaving behind the wetland, the path went beyond the river and climbed into the sunshine and onto dry ground, towards the huts. From the river onwards, all the pastures were well maintained.
"Hey," said Bruno, "it's about time."
"I'm sorry, I had to spend some time with my father."
"Is that your father? What's he like?"
"I don't know," I said. "He's fine." I had started talking like him. We hadn't seen each other in 15 days, and we felt like old friends. My father greeted him as if he were one, and even Bruno's uncle made an effort to seem hospitable. He disappeared into one of the huts and came out with a piece of Toma cheese, some mochetta salami, and a flask of wine. But his face hardly accorded with these gestures of welcome. He was a man who seemed marked by his own worst inner thoughts, as if they were carved there in his features. He had an unkempt, bristling, and almost white beard, its mustache thicker and gray, eyebrows that were arched permanently, giving him a distrusting air, and eyes that were sky blue. The hand my father stretched out had taken him by surprise, and the movement he made to shake it seemed hesitant, unnatural. Only when unstopping the wine and filling the glasses did he seem back on his own familiar territory. Bruno had something to show me, so we left them to their drinks and went for a wander around. I took in the farmstead that he had told me so much about. It exuded an ancient dignity, whose presence you could still feel in the dry stone walls, in certain enormous angular stones, in the hand-hewn roof beams, as well as a more recent air of poverty, like a layer of grease and dust over everything. The longest of the cabins was being used as a cowshed, humming with flies and encrusted with dung right up to its threshold. In the second, its broken windows stopped with bits of rag and its roof patched with metal sheets, Luigi Guglielmina and his heirs lived. The third was the cellar. Bruno took me to see it rather than the room in which he slept. Even in Grana, he had never invited me into his home. He said,
"I'm learning how to make the toma."
"Meaning what?"
"The cheese. Come."
The cellar surprised me. It was cool and shadowy, the only really clean place in the whole alpeggio. The thick shelves made of larch had been recently washed. The cheeses were being aged there, their crusts moistened with brine. They were so polished, round, and symmetrical as to seem laid out in display for some kind of competition.
"Did you make them?" I asked.
"No, no. For now I only turn them, and that's it. They're nice ones, no?"
"What do you mean, turn them?"
"Once every week I turn them over and sprinkle them with salt. Then I wash everything down and tidy up in here.
They're really nice ones, I said. Outside, on the other hand, lay plastic buckets, a pile of half-rotted wood, a stove made out of a diesel oil drum, a bathtub converted into a drinking trough, scattered potato peelings, and the odd bone picked clean by the dogs. It wasn't just an absence of decorum. There was a perceptible contempt for things, a certain kind of pleasure in mistreating them and letting them go to pot that I had also begun to recognize in Grana. It was as if these places had already had their fate sealed, that it was a waste of time and effort to try to maintain them. My father and Bruno's uncle were already on their second glass, and we found them in the midst of a discussion about the economics of small alpine farmsteads. My father must have initiated the conversation. When it came to other people's lives, he was more interested in their work than anything else. How many head of cattle, how many liters of milk a day, what the yield was like regarding the production of cheese. Luigi Guglielmino was more than happy to discuss it with someone who knew what they were talking about, and he made his calculations out loud to show that, what with current prices and the absurd regulations imposed by cattle breeders, his work no longer made economic sense and was continued by him only because of his passion for it. He said,
"When I die, within 10 years it will all revert to forest up here. Then they'll be happy."
"Don't your children like this kind of work?" my father asked.
"Oh, sure. What they don't like is working their asses off."
What struck me most was not hearing him talk in such terms, but his prophecy. It had never occurred to me that the pastures had once been wooded, and that they could revert to being so again. I looked at the cows scattered over the grazing and made an effort to imagine these fields colonized by the first thick covering of weeds and shrubs, erasing every sign of what had once been there. The drainage ditches, the dry stone walls, the paths, eventually even the houses themselves. Bruno had in the meantime lit the fire in the open-air stove. Without waiting to be told, he went to the bath to fill a saucepan with water and began to peel potatoes with his penknife. There were so many things that he knew how to do. He made a pasta dish and put it on the table with the boiled potatoes, the toma, the macetta, and the wine. At that point, his cousins appeared, two tall and thick-set youths, about 25 years old, who sat down to eat with their heads lowered, looked up at us briefly, and then went off for a siesta. Bruno's uncle watched them going, and in the grimace contorting his lips, it was clear to see that he despised them. My father paid no heed to such things. At the end of the meal, he stretched, put his hands behind his head, and looked at the sky as if he was about to enjoy a show. And he said as much.
"What a show!"
His vacation was nearly over, and he had already started to look at the mountains with nostalgia. He would no longer be able to make it to certain summits that year. We had some above us, all scree, spurs, pinnacles, rivers of fallen rock, gullies of debris, and broken ridges. They looked like the ruins of an immense fortress destroyed by cannon fire, poised precariously before collapsing completely. What could indeed be considered a real show, in fact, for someone like my father.
"What are these mountains called?" he asked.
A strange question, I thought, given the amount of time he spent poring over his wall map. Bruno's uncle glanced up as if he were looking for signs of rain, and with a vague gesture said,
"Grainen."
"Which one is Grainen?"
"This one. For us, it's the mountain of Grana."
"All of these peaks together?"
"Of course. We don't give names to peaks here. It's the region."
Having eaten and drunk, he was beginning to get fed up with having us around.
"Have you ever been there?" my father persisted. "Right up to the heights, I mean."
"When I was young, I used to go with my father, hunting."
"And have you been to the glacier?"
"No, I never had the chance, but I would have liked to," he admitted.
"I'm thinking of going up there tomorrow," my father said. "I'm taking the boy to trample some snow. If it's all right with you, we could take yours with us, too."
This is what my father had been aiming at all along. Luigi Guglielmino took a moment to understand what he was saying.
"Yours?"
Then he remembered Bruno, who was there beside me. We were playing with one of the dogs, one of that year's puppies. But we were also hanging on every word.
"Do you feel like going?"
he asked.
Oh, yes, said Bruno.
The uncle frowned. He was more used to saying no than yes. But perhaps he felt cornered by this stranger, or who knows, perhaps for once he felt sorry for the boy.
Well, go then, he said.
Then he put the cork in the bottle and got up from the table, tired now of the effort to appear anything other than who he was. The glacier fascinated the scientist in my father before it did the climber. It reminded him of his studies in physics and chemistry, of the mythology by which he was formed. The next day, as we climbed toward the Metsalama refuge, he told us a story which resembled one of those myths. The glacier, he said, is the memory of past winters which the mountain safeguards for us. Above a certain altitude, it stores the memory, and if we wish to know about a winter in the distant past, it's up there that we need to go.
It's called the level of permanent snow cover, he explained. It's where the summer cannot melt all of the snow that falls in winter. Some of it lasts until autumn and is buried beneath the snow of the next winter. Therefore, it's saved. Under the new snow, little by little, it gradually turns to ice. It adds a layer to the growth of the glacier, just like growth rings in tree trunks, and by counting them, we can know how old it is. Except that a glacier doesn't just stand there on top of the mountain. It moves. All the time, it does nothing but slide downwards.
Why? I ask.
Why do you think?
Because it's heavy, said Bruno.
Exactly, my father said. The glacier is heavy and the rock beneath it very smooth. That's why it slides down, slowly but without ever stopping. It slides down the mountain until it reaches a level that's too warm for it. We call that the melt level. Can you see it there, down below?
We were walking on a moraine that seemed made of sand. A spit of ice and rubble jutted out beneath us, way down below the path. It was crisscrossed by rivulets that collected into a small lake, which was opaque, metallic, icy-looking.
That water down there, my father said. It hasn't come from the snow that fell this year. It's from snow that the mountain has stored for who knows how long. Perhaps it's from snow that fell 100 winters ago.
100? Really? Asked Bruno.
Perhaps even more. It's difficult to determine exactly. You'd need to know the exact degree of incline and friction. You can try an experiment first.
How?
Ah, that's easy. Do you see those crevasses up there above? Tomorrow we'll go there, throw in a coin, then go and sit in the river and wait for it to arrive.
My father laughed. Bruno continued looking at the crevasses and at the glacier where it jutted below, and you could tell that he was fascinated by the idea. For my part, I was not so interested in bygone winters. I could feel in the pit of my stomach that we were about to go beyond the level at which, on previous occasions, our ascent had come to an end. The timing was also unusual. In the afternoon, we had felt a few drops of rain, and now, with evening falling, we were heading into fog. It felt strange to discover, at the end of the moraine, a wooden building of 2 stories. The smell of fumes from a generator announced its proximity, followed by voices shouting in a language I did not recognize. The wooden platform at the entrance, pockmarked by crampons, was cluttered with rucksacks, ropes, sweaters, vests, and thick socks hung out everywhere to dry, and by climbers crossing it in unlaced boots, carrying their washing. That evening, the refuge was full. No one would be turned away, but some would have to sleep on benches or even on tables. Bruno and I were the youngest members of this gathering by far. We were amongst the first to eat, and to make room for others to do so, we went immediately upstairs afterwards to the large dorm where we would be sharing a bed. Up there, fully dressed under a rough blanket, we spent a long while waiting for sleep to come. Through the window we could not see the stars or the gleam of the lights in the valley below, only the burning ends of the cigarettes of those who went outside for a smoke. We listened to the men on the ground floor. After supper, they were comparing itineraries for the next day, discussing the uncertain weather conditions and recounting other nights spent in refuges, and old exploits made from them. My father had ordered a liter of wine and joined the others, and every so often I could make out his voice. Despite not having any conquest of summits in prospect, he had nevertheless made a name for himself as the guy who was taking 2 young boys up a glacier, and the role filled him with pride. He had encountered several people from his own neck of the woods and was exchanging jokes with them in Veneto dialect. Being shy, I felt embarrassed for him. Bruno said, "Your father knows a thing or two, doesn't he?" "He sure does," I said. "It's good that he teaches you about it." "Why, doesn't yours?" "I don't know. It always seems like I irritate him." I thought to myself that my father was good at talking, but that listening was not his strong point. Nor was paying much attention to me, otherwise he would have noticed how I was feeling. I had struggled to eat, and it would have been better to have had nothing, tormented as I now was by nausea. The smell of soup rising from the kitchen was making things worse. I was taking deep breaths to calm my stomach, and Bruno noticed. "Are you not feeling well?" "Not really." "Would you like me to call your father?" "No, no, it'll go away in a minute." I was keeping my stomach warm with my hands. I would have liked more than anything to be in my own bed and to hear my mother nearby in front of the stove. We remained in silence until at 10 the supervisor announced lights out and turned off the generator, plunging the refuge into darkness. A little while later we saw the light from the head torches of men coming upstairs in search of somewhere to sleep. My father also passed by, the grappa heavy on his breath, to see how we were. I kept my eyes shut and pretended to be asleep. In the morning, we left before daybreak. Now the fog filled the valleys below us, and the sky was clear, the color of mother of pearl, with the last stars slowly fading out as the light spread. We had not anticipated dawn by much. The mountaineers heading for the most distant peaks had already left some time ago. We had heard them fumbling in the middle of the night and could now see some of them roped together up high, nothing more than miniature shipwrecks in a sea of white. My father attached for us the crampons that he had hired, and roped us together at a length of 5 meters from each other, himself first, then Bruno, then me. He strapped our chests with a complicated arrangement of the rope around our anoraks, but he hadn't tied such knots for years, and our preparation turned out to be long-winded and laborious. We ended up being the last to leave the refuge. We had still to cover a stretch of scree which our crampons knocked against and tended to get stuck in, and the rope hampered my movement and made me feel clumsy, burdened with too much gear. But everything changed the moment I set foot on snow. From my baptism on the glacier I remember this, an unexpected strength in my legs, the steel points biting through the hard snow, the crampons that gripped to perfection. I had woken feeling reasonably well, but after a while the warmth of the refuge dissipated and the nausea began to grow. Up ahead, my father was pulling the group on. I could see that he was in a hurry. Although he had claimed that he only wanted to have a short excursion, I suspected that he harbored a secret hope of reaching some peak or other, surprising the other climbers by turning up at the summit with the two of us in tow. But I was struggling. Between one step and the next, it was as if a hand was wringing my stomach. Whenever I stopped to get my breath, the rope between myself and Bruno tautened, forcing him to stop as well, the tension then reaching my father, who would turn around to look at me, annoyed.
"What's going on?" he asked.
He thought I was playing up.
"Let's get a move on."
As the sun rose, three black shadows appeared on the glacier next to us. Then the snow lost its bluish tinge and became blindingly white, and almost immediately afterwards began to give way beneath our crampons. The clouds below us were swelling with the heat of the morning, and even I understood that soon they would rise up as they had the day before. The idea of reaching anywhere was becoming more and more unrealistic, but my father was not the kind of person to admit the fact and withdraw. On the contrary, he was stubbornly determined to plow on. At a certain point, we encountered a crevasse. He gauged its width carefully by eye, and with one determined step got across it, planted the ice pick in the snow, and wound the rope around it to reel Bruno in. I no longer had any interest in what we were doing. The sunrise, the glacier, the chain of summits that surrounded us, the clouds that separated us from the world. I was indifferent to all of this otherworldly beauty. All I wanted was for someone to tell me how much further we had to walk. I got to the edge of the crevasse where Bruno, in front of me, was leaning out to look into it. My father told him to take a deep breath and to jump. While waiting for my turn, I looked around. Beneath us, on one side, the mountain's incline became sheerer, and the glacier split in a steep serac. Beyond the wreck of broken, collapsed, and piled-up blocks, the refuge from where we had started out was being engulfed by fog. It seemed to me now that we would never get back, and when I looked at Bruno for support, he was already on the other side of the crevasse. My father was slapping him on the back, congratulating him on the jump that he had executed. Not I. I would never be able to get across. My stomach gave in, and I threw up my breakfast onto the snow. And so it was that my altitude sickness was no longer a secret. My father became frightened. He rushed to my aid in alarm, jumping back across the crevasse and in doing so tangling the ropes that held the three of us together. His fear surprised me. I had expected his anger instead. But at the time, I had not realized the risks he had taken by leading us up there. 11 years old, poorly equipped and pursued by bad weather, we were being dragged up the glacier by his obstinacy. He knew that the only cure for altitude sickness was to go down to a lower level, and he did not hesitate before starting the descent. He reversed the order on the rope so that I could walk ahead and stop when I felt unwell. There was nothing left in my stomach, but every so often I was convulsed by dry retching, spitting out drool. Soon we were entering the fog. From his end of the rope, my father asked, "How are you feeling? Do you have a headache?" "I don't think so."
"And how's your stomach?"
"A bit better," I answered, though what I felt above all was weak.
"Take this," said Bruno.
He gave me a handful of snow that he had compressed in his fist until it had turned to ice. I tried sucking it. Thanks partly to this and partly to the relief afforded by the descent, my stomach began to calm down. It was a morning in August in 1984, the last memory I have of that summer. The next day Bruno would return to the high pastures and my father to Milan. But at that moment, the three of us were on the glacier, together, in a way that would never happen again, with a rope that joined each of us to another, whether we wanted it to or not. I kept stumbling over the crampons and could not walk straight. Bruno was immediately behind me, and soon I heard above the sound of our footsteps in the snow his, "Oh, oh, oh." It was the call with which he brought the cows back to the stable.
"Eh, eh, eh. Oh, oh, oh."
He was using it to bring me back to the refuge, given that I could hardly stay on my feet by now. I abandoned myself to his song and let my legs adopt its rhythm, and in that way no longer had to think about anything.
"But did you look into the crevasse?" he asked. "Holy shit, it was deep."
I did not answer. I still had in my eyes the image I had seen of them there, so close and triumphant, like father and son. In front of me now, the fog and the snow formed a uniform whiteness, and I was concentrating only on not falling. Bruno said nothing else and resumed his chanting. Three. Winter, during those years, became for me the season of nostalgia. My father detested skiers and would not countenance mingling with them. There was something offensive to him in the game of going down the mountain without the effort required to climb it first, along a slope smoothed by snowcats and equipped with a ski lift. He despised them because they arrived in herds and left behind them nothing but ruins. Sometimes in the summer we would come across the pylon of a chairlift, or the remains of a caterpillar track stuck on a threadbare piste, or what was left of a disused cable station at altitude, a rusted wheel on a block of cement in the middle of scree.
"What this really needs is a bomb under it," my father would say, and he was not joking.
It was the same frame of mind with which he would watch at Christmas the news items devoted to skiing holidays. Thousands of people from the cities invaded the alpine valleys, got into queues at those stations, and hurtled down our paths. And he would dissociate himself from it all, locking himself away in the apartment in Milan. My mother once suggested that we should take a day trip to Grana, so that I could see it in the snow, and my father replied tersely, "No." He wouldn't like it. In the winter, the mountain was not fit for humankind and should be given a wide berth. According to his philosophy of ascending and coming down, or of going up above to escape the things that tormented you below, the climbing season needed to be followed by one of seriousness, by the period of work, of life on the flat, and of black moods. In this way, I too began to feel nostalgia for being in the mountains, the affliction to which I had seen him subjected for years without understanding its cause. Now I too found myself capable of becoming spellbound when La Grigna appeared at the end of an avenue. I would reread the pages of the Alpine Club Guide as if it were a personal diary, drinking in its antiquated prose, and it would give me the illusion of retracing the paths it described step by step, climbing up steep grassy ridges to reach a neglected alp, and from here, proceeding through scattered boulders and the residual ice field, to then attain the crest of the summit in the proximity of a pronounced depression. But in the meantime, my legs became gradually paler, their scratches and scabs healed, and they forgot the stings of nettles, the icy sensation of fording streams without socks or shoes, and the relief afforded by cool bedsheets after an afternoon in the blazing sun. Nothing in the winter city could strike me with the same force. I observed it from behind a filter that rendered it faded and indistinct, just a fog of people and cars that needed to be got through twice a day. And when I looked from the window at the avenue below, the days spent in Grana seemed so far off as to make me question whether they had actually existed. Could I have invented them, just dreamed them up? But I only felt this until I noticed in a new kind of light on the balcony, in a bud emerging in the grass between two lanes of traffic, that the spring was coming even to Milan, and my nostalgia turned to anticipation of the moment when I would go back up there again. Bruno waited with the same excitement for that day to arrive, except that I came and went and he stayed. I think that from his vantage point in the fields he must have kept an eye out for our return, since he would come to find us within an hour of our arrival, shouting, "Berio!" from the courtyard. This was the nickname with which he had baptized me. "Come on," he would say, not bothering with any kind of greeting, or with saying anything else for that matter, as if we had last seen each other just the day before. And it was true. The intervening months were cancelled in an instant, and our friendship seemed to be lived in a single, interrupted summer. Yet Bruno, in the meantime, had been growing up more quickly than me. He was almost always covered in dirt from the stables and refused to come inside the house. He would wait on the balcony, leaning on the balustrade, which we almost never did ourselves, since it would move the moment you touched it, convincing us that one of these days it would collapse. He would look over his shoulder as if checking to see whether he'd been followed. He had absconded from his cows and was taking me away from my books to have adventures which he did not want to ruin by talking about them. "Where are we going?" I would ask while lacing my boots. "Into the mountains," he would limit himself to saying, with a mocking tone that he had developed, perhaps the same tone that he used when answering his uncle. He was smiling. All I needed to do was to trust him. My mother trusted me, and would often enough repeat that she didn't worry because she knew that I would do nothing wrong. Nothing wrong, rather than reckless or stupid, as if she was alluding to quite other dangers that would come my way in life. She did not resort to prohibitions or to other advice before letting us leave. Going into the mountains with Bruno had nothing to do with the peaks. Although we did follow a path into the woods, climbing quickly for half an hour, we would at some point, known only to him, leave the beaten track and continue along other routes. Up a gorge, even, or through the thickest fir cover. It was a mystery to me how he got his bearings. He walked fast, following an internal map, which indicated passageways where all I could see was a collapsed bank or a scar that looked too steep. But right at the last moment, between two twisted pines, the rock would reveal a fissure that we could get a purchase on to climb, and a ledge, which had been invisible at first, would allow us to cross it with ease. Some of these trails had been first opened up with the blows of pickaxes. When I asked him who had used them, he would say, "The miners." Or, alternatively, "The woodcutters," pointing out the telltale signs that I was incapable of noticing. The winding gear of a cable lift, rusted and overgrown with weeds. The earth that beneath a drier layer was still blackened by fire where a charcoal works had been. The woods were littered with these excavations, mounds, and ruins, which Bruno interpreted for me as if they were phrases written in a dead language, Together with these cryptic signs, he would teach me a dialect that I found less abstract than Italian. As soon as I was in the mountains, it was as if I would need to substitute the concrete language of things for the abstract language of books, now that the things themselves were tangible and I could touch them with my own hands. The larch, la bregna, the spruce, la pezza, the Swiss pine, la rulla. An overhanging rock under which to take cover from the rain was a barma. A stone was a berio, and so was I, Pietro. I was very fond of that nickname. Every river cut a valley, and so was called a valle. Every valley had two sides with contrasting characteristics, an adre, nicely exposed to the sun, where there were villages and fields, and an enverse, that was damp and in shadow, left to the forest and to wildlife. But of the two, it was this reverse side that we preferred. There, no one could disturb us, and we could go hunting for treasure. There really were mines in the woods surrounding Grana. Tunnels closed off, boarded up with a few planks that had already been trespassed through before us. In the old times, according to Bruno, they had found gold there, searching for seams all over the mountains. But they had not managed to extract everything. Surely there must be a little remaining. And so we would enter into blind tunnels which ended in nothing after a few meters, and into others that went deep and were winding and pitch black inside. The ceilings were so low as to make it difficult to walk upright. The water that dripped down the walls gave the impression that the whole thing might cave in at any moment. I knew how dangerous it was, and I also knew that I was betraying my mother's trust, since there was nothing very sensible about poking around in such death traps. The sense of guilt I felt ruined any pleasure there might have been in doing so. I longed to be like Bruno, to have the courage to rebel openly and to accept any punishment that might follow with my head held high. Instead, I disobeyed furtively and was ashamed of what I had got away with. I would think about these things as my feet were soaked by the puddles of water in there. We never did find gold. Sooner or later, the tunnels turned out to have been blocked by a cave-in, or just became too dark to go along any further, and there was no choice but to retreat. We made up for the disappointment by ransacking some ruins on the way home. Shepherds' huts that we came across in the woods, constructed from whatever came to hand there, resembling burrows. Bruno would pretend to be discovering them with me. I suspect that he knew every one of those overgrown cabins, but it was more fun to be shoulder-barging open their doors as if for the first time. Inside, we would purloin a dented bowl or the terminally blunted blade of a scythe and imagine them to be valuable finds. And in the village, before parting, we would divide the spoils. In the evening, my mother would ask me where we had been. "Just around here," I would answer with a shrug. In front of the stove, I did not give her much satisfaction now. "Did you find anything worth seeing?" "Of course, Mom. The woods." She would give me a melancholy look as if she were losing me. She really believed that the silence between two people was the origin of all their troubles. "All I want to know is that you are okay," she would say, giving up and abandoning me to my thoughts. In the other battle she was fighting at Grana, she held firm. From the beginning she had taken Bruno's education to heart, like a personal crusade, but she knew full well that she could achieve nothing on her own. She needed to forge alliances with the women of his family. She had understood that his mother would be of no help at all, so she concentrated her efforts on his aunt. This is how my mother operated, knocking on doors and gaining entrance to homes, returning in a friendly but determined manner, not relenting until the aunt eventually committed to sending him to school during the winter, and over to our place to do homework in the summer. This was already quite an achievement. I don't know what the uncle thought about the matter. Perhaps up there in the Alpeggio he was cursing the lot of us. Or perhaps, in truth, nobody in that family really cared anything about the boy. And so it is that I remember long hours spent with Bruno in our kitchen doing history and geography revision, while outside the woods and the river and the sky beckoned. He would be sent to us 3 times a week, scrubbed and well-dressed for the occasion. My mother would get him to read aloud from my books, Stevenson, Verne, Twain, Jack London, and would leave them with him after the lesson so that he could continue practicing while he was up in the pastures. Bruno liked reading novels, but studying grammar always sent him into a crisis. For him it was like studying a foreign language, and seeing how he got entangled with the rules of Italian, failing to spell a word correctly or stuttering over a conjugation, I felt humiliated on his behalf and annoyed with my mother. I could not see the justice of what they were forcing him to do. And yet Bruno did not utter a single word of protest or complaint. He understood how much it mattered to her, and perhaps having never experienced before what it was like to matter to someone, he struggled hard to learn. Only on rare occasions during the summer was he allowed to come walking with us, and these were his holidays, the reward for the efforts that went into his studies, whether it was a summit we were taken to by my father, or just a field where my mother would spread out a blanket for lunch. On these occasions I would see Bruno transformed. Though undisciplined by nature, he would adapt to the rules and the rituals of our family. And whilst with me he already behaved like a grown-up, with my parents he would happily regress to his proper age. He allowed my mother to feed him, to dress him, to caress him. While my father inspired in him a respect that bordered on adulation, I could see it in the way he would follow behind him on the path, and how he would listen in rapt silence when my father started explaining something. These were perfectly ordinary moments in the life of a family, but Bruno had never experienced anything like them, and part of me felt proud of them, as if they were gifts that I myself had bestowed on him. On the other hand, I would sometimes watch him with my father to try to gauge the nature of the understanding that there was between them, and I would feel that Bruno would have made a good son for him. Perhaps not a better one than I was, but in a certain sense a more suitable one. Bruno was full of questions for him that he would ask naturally, without hesitation. He had the confidence that allowed him to get close to my father and the physical strength to follow him anywhere. I would think these things, but then try to suppress them, as if they were something about which I should be ashamed. Eventually, Bruno passed not only the first grade of senior school, but the second and even the third, achieving an average mark in the exam. It was such an event in his family that his aunt phoned us immediately in Milan to give us the news. What a peculiar word, I thought, and wondered who had come up with it, since there was nothing average about Bruno. My mother, on the other hand, was simply delighted, and when we went back up to Grana, she took him a prize, a box of chisels and gouges for working with wood. Then she began to ask herself what else she could do for him. The summer of 1987 arrived. We were 14. We spent an entire month dedicated to a systematic exploration of the river, not from its banks this time or from the paths that intersected it from the woods, but in the water itself, in the current, jumping from rock to rock or wading within it. We had never heard of canyoning, if such a thing even existed at that time, but did it anyway, albeit in reverse, proceeding upstream from the bridge at Grana, climbing back up the valley. Just above the village, we entered a long gorge of calm water, in the shadow of banks densely covered in vegetation. There were large pools infested with insects, tangles of submerged wood, old, wary trout that would scatter at our approach. Further up, the gradient became problematic, making the river flow headlong, its progress all leaps and falls. Where we could not manage to scramble over, we would rig up a rope to cross the rapids, or use a fallen tree trunk by floating it onto the water and wedging it between rocks to make a pontoon. Sometimes even a single, modest waterfall would cost us hours of work. But this is what made the feat special. We planned to negotiate such passages one by one, then connect them all, going up the entire length of the river on one glorious day at the end of summer. First, though, we needed to discover its source. Towards the August bank holiday, we had already gone beyond the territory of Bruno's uncle. There was a large tributary which provided the alpine farmsteads with water, and a little way after this fork, a rudimentary bridge consisting of a few planks of wood provided a crossing. After that, the river narrowed and presented us with no further difficulty. I understood from the thinning out of the tree cover that we were getting to a level of 2,000 meters. The alders and birches disappeared from the banks, all other trees giving way to the larch. Above our heads was that world of rock and stone that Luigi Guglielmina had called Grenon. At this point, the bed of the river lost its usual appearance, that of something excavated and shaped by the water, becoming instead nothing but scree. The water literally vanished beneath our feet. It escaped beneath the stones here, amid the contorted roots of a juniper. This is not how I had imagined my river ending up, and I was disappointed. I turned towards Bruno, who was climbing a few steps behind me. All afternoon he had been keeping himself to himself, lost in his own thoughts. When this mood came over him, the only thing I could do was follow after him in silence, hoping that it would pass. But as soon as he caught sight of the spring, he snapped out of it. He had sensed my disappointment at a glance. "Wait," he said. He signaled to me to keep quiet and listen, and looked at the scree at our feet. That day the air was not still like it was at the height of summer. A cold wind blew over the tepid stones, and passing through the fading plants, carried away soft clusters of seeds and set up a rustling in the trees. By listening hard, together with this rustling, I could hear water gurgling, a sound different from the ones it makes above ground, deeper and more muffled. It seemed to be coming from beneath the scree. I understood what it was and began to climb again to follow it, searching like a dowser for the water that I could hear but not see. Bruno let me go on ahead, already knowing what we would find. What we found was a lake hidden in a basin at the foot of the Grainon. It was circular, and at 200 or 300 meters across was the largest that I'd ever seen in the mountains. The marvelous thing about alpine lakes is that you never expect them while climbing, unless you know already that they are there. That you don't catch sight of them until the very last step over a ridge, at which point the view suddenly opens up before your eyes. The basin was all scree on its sunlit side, and as you moved your gaze gradually towards the shadows, you saw that it became covered at first by willows and rhododendrons, and then by more woods. In its middle was this lake. Observing it, I was able to understand how it had been made. The ancient avalanche that could be seen from below, from Bruno's uncle's pastures, had sealed the valley like a dam. The lake had been formed above the dam, collecting the water that ran off from the surrounding snow, before resurfacing downhill, filtered by the scree, becoming in the process the river that we knew. I liked the fact that it was born in this way. It seemed to me an origin worthy of a great river. "What's this lake called?" I asked.
"I have no idea," Bruno said. "Grainon. Almost everything's called that around here."
His previous mood had returned. He sat down on the grass, and I remained standing next to him. It was easier to look at the lake than to look at each other. A few meters in front of us, a large rock emerged from the water like a small island, and it was useful to have something to fix my gaze on.
"Your parents have spoken to my uncle," said Bruno after a while. "Did you know about that?" "No," I lied.
"Strange. I don't understand what's going on at all."
"About what?"
"About the secrets you have between you."
"So what did they talk to your uncle about?"
"About me,"
he replied.
Now I sat down next to him. What he was about to tell me came as no surprise. My parents had been discussing it for some time now, and I had not needed to listen behind doors in order to discover their intentions. The previous day they had suggested to Luigi Guglielmina that in September we should take Bruno with us, take him to Milan. They had offered to take him into our home and to enroll him in a college, in a technical or professional institute, whichever he preferred. They were thinking about a trial year. If Bruno wasn't happy with the arrangement, he would be able to give up and return to Grana next summer. If, on the other hand, it all worked out, then they would be happy to keep him with us until his graduation. At that point, he would be free to decide what he wanted to do with the rest of his life. Even in the account of this given by Bruno, I could recognize the voice of my mother. "Happy to keep him with us, free to decide, the rest of his life." I said, "Your uncle will never agree to it."
"Oh, but he will," said Bruno. "And do you know why?"
"Why?"
"For the money."
He dug around in the ground with a finger, picked up a pebble, and added,
"Who's going to pay for it? That's all that interests my uncle. Your parents have said that they'll take care of everything, board and lodging, school, the lot. For him, it's a real bargain."
"And what does your aunt say about it?"
"It's fine by her."
"And your mother?"
Bruno snorted. He threw the pebble into the water. It was so small that it made no sound.
What my mother always says, the usual, a big nothing.
There was a layer of dried mud on the rocks on the bank, a black crust showing the level the lake had reached in spring. Now the snowfields that fed it had been reduced to gray stains in the gullies, and if the summer were to continue, it would end up by making them disappear altogether. Without the snow, who knows what would happen to the lake?
"And what about you?" I asked.
"What about me?
Would you like to?"
"To come to Milan?" said Bruno. "I haven't a clue. Do you know that ever since yesterday I've been trying to imagine what it would be like, and I can't do it. I have no idea what it would be like."
We remained in silence. I, who knew only too well what it was like, did not have to imagine anything in order to be opposed to the idea. Bruno would have hated Milan, and Milan would have ruined Bruno, just like when his aunt washed and dressed him up and sent him around to us to conjugate verbs. I really could not understand why my parents were going out of their way to turn him into something that he wasn't. What was wrong with letting him graze cows for the rest of his life? I was unaware of the selfishness of this thought, that it wasn't really concerned with Bruno, with his own wishes and his future, but only with the use I could continue to make of him. I was thinking of my summers, my companion, my own experience of the mountain. I hoped that up there nothing would ever change, not even the charred shacks or mounds of manure lining the road. That he should stay the same, always along with the piles of manure and the ruins, frozen in time and awaiting my arrival.
"Well, maybe you should tell them," I suggested.
"Tell them what?"
"That you don't want to go to Milan, that you want to stay here."
Bruno turned to look at me. He raised his eyebrows. He had not expected such advice from me. Although he may have been thinking the very same thing himself, coming from me it did not seem right.
"Are you crazy?" he said. "I'm not staying here. I've spent my whole life going up and down this mountain."
Then he got to his feet, and there on the grass where we stood, he cupped his hands round his mouth and shouted,
"Oh, can you hear me? It's me, Bruno! I'm leaving!"
From the other side of the lake, the slope of the Grenon sent back to us an echo of his cry. We heard some stones falling. His shout had startled a group of chamois that was now clambering up the scree. It was Bruno who pointed them out to me. They were passing through rocks which made them almost invisible, but when they crossed a snowfield I was able to count them. It was a small herd of 5. They climbed up that stain of snow in single file, reached the crest, and lingered there for a moment, as if to look at us for one last time before going. Then, one by one, they disappeared down the other side. Our 4,000er that summer was meant to be the Castor. We would scale one of these each year, my father and I, on the Monte Rosa so as to conclude the season on a high, when we were best trained up to do so. I hadn't stopped going onto the glacier, but neither had I stopped suffering its effects. I had just become accustomed to feeling unwell and to the fact that this sickness formed a normal part of that world. Like getting up before dawn, or the freeze-dried food in the refuges, or the cawing of crows on the heights. It was a way of going into the mountains that for me had lost all sense of adventure. It was a brutal putting of one foot after the other before vomiting my heart out at the top. I hated doing it, and found myself hating that white desert every time. And yet I was proud of going above 4,000 meters again, as further proof of my courage. In 1985, my father's black felt tip ink had reached the Vincent. By 1986, the Nifetti. He considered the ascent of these summits to be a kind of training for me. He'd consulted a doctor and was convinced that I would grow out of my altitude sickness, so that over the course of 3 or 4 years we would reach the point when we could do more serious things, such as crossing the Luscombe or the rock faces of Dufour. But what I remember most about Castor, even more than its elongated crests, was the vigil that we shared in the refuge. A plate of pasta, a half-liter of wine on the table, the mountaineers nearby arguing amongst themselves, ruddy-faced from the sun and from fatigue. The prospect of the next day created in the room a kind of concentration. In front of me, my father was leafing through the guest book, his favorite reading in a refuge. He spoke German well and understood French, and every so often he would translate a passage from these languages of the Alps. Someone had returned to a summit after 30 years and thanked God. Someone else regretted the absence of a friend. He was moved by these things to the point where he took up the pen to make his own contribution to that collective diary. When he got up to refill his carafe, I looked at what he had written. His handwriting was dense and nervous, difficult to decipher if you were not already familiar with it. I read, "I'm here with my 14-year-old son, Pietro. These will be my last occasions at the head of the rope, because soon he will be the one pulling me up. Don't much feel like going back to the city, but I'll take with me the memory of these days as the most beautiful refuge." It was signed, Giovanni Guasti. Rather than making me feel moved or proud, these words just annoyed me. I detected in them something that sounded false and sentimental, a rhetoric of the mountains that did not correspond to reality. If it was such a paradise, then why did we not stay and live up there? Why were we taking away a friend who had been born and raised there? And if the city was so revolting, why were we forcing him to live in it with us? This is what I would like to have asked my father, and my mother as well, come to think of it. How is it that you are so sure of knowing what's best for the course of another person's life? How is it that you don't have the slightest doubt that he might know better than you? But when my father returned, he was in high spirits. It was the third from last day of his holiday, a Friday in August of his 46th year, and he was in an alpine refuge with his only son. He had brought another glass and half-filled it for me. Perhaps in his imagination, now that I was growing up and getting over my altitude sickness, our relationship as father and son would be transformed into something different. Climbing companions, just like he had written in the book. Drinking companions. Perhaps he really did imagine us like this in a few years' time, sitting at a table at 3,500 meters, drinking red wine and studying maps of the routes, with no more secrets between us.
"How's your stomach doing?" he asked.
"It's not bad."
"And your legs?"
"They're really good."
"Excellent. Tomorrow we'll have fun."
My father raised his glass. I did the same, tasted the wine, and felt that I liked it. While I was getting it down, a guy sitting nearby burst out laughing, said something in German, and clapped me hard on the back, as if I had just been initiated into the great brotherhood of men, and he was welcoming me into it. The next evening, we went back to Grana as veterans of the glacier. My father, with his shirt unbuttoned and his rucksack slung over one shoulder, and with a hobbling gait due to the blisters on his feet. I, as ravenous as a wolf, since as soon as we descended from altitude, my stomach realized that it had been empty for 2 days. My mother was waiting for us with a hot bath and supper already on the table. Later on, the time for telling our story would come. My father tried to describe the color of ice in the crevasses, the vertiginous nature of the north faces, the elegance of the cornices of snow on the crests. While I, for my part, had only blurred recollections of such visions, fogged as they were by nausea. I usually kept quiet. I had already learned a fact which my father never resigned himself to, namely, that it was impossible to convey what it feels like up there to those who have stayed below. But that evening we did not get around to telling my mother anything. I was about to have my bath when I heard the voice of a man ranting down in the courtyard. I went to the window and pulled back the curtain. I saw a character who was gesticulating and yelling words that I could not understand. My father was the only other one out there. He had hung his thick socks on the balcony and was bathing his aching feet in the trough, getting up from where he sat on its rim to confront the stranger. For a moment, I thought it might be a farmer furious at the misuse of his water. In Grana, they would leap at any pretext to take offense from an incomer. It was easy to identify the locals. They all moved in the same way, had the same marked facial features from out of which, between cheekbones and forehead, a pair of sky-blue eyes peered. This man was smaller than my father, except for the muscular arms and huge hands that were completely out of proportion to the rest of his body,
With those hands, he grabbed the two sides of my father's shirt just below the collar. It looked as if he wanted to pick him up. My father spread his arms. I was seeing him from behind and imagined that he would be saying, "Calm down, calm down."